Welcome to the March Change Your World Virtual Summit, put on today by the Public Speakers Association. I'm so excited to introduce to you Patricia O'Brien. Patricia, why don't you just take it on from here?
Okay, great. Yes, thank you, everybody. My name is Patricia O'Brien, and for as long as I can remember, I have been speaking about health and wellness topics to children and adults, and today I'm extremely excited to speak with you about a couple of areas which are near and dear to my heart, environmental and food toxicity. And what I'm doing here today is helping you to become more aware of what's out there. And with this information, you can perhaps make some adjustments and make some swaps or avoid this type of toxicity in your life, or just become more aware of what it is so that you can counteract it if you realize that over the past few years perhaps you have come in contact with some toxins. And with that, like I mentioned, it's mostly categorized as both environmental and food toxins. So we'll start with the environmental end. When I speak about some examples and some solutions and alternatives, what I do want to start with, though, is a reason why you should take the reins in your own life, in your health and wellness, more so than relying upon the powers that be or the companies and government organizations that are in place, which you would think have your best interests in mind. And let's just say that they sometimes can take a little longer than perhaps they ought to in sharing the facts. And in the meantime, you might be suffering some of the long-term effects. Specifically in the food industry, I'll talk about with the 1950s. In the 1950s, there were heart attacks were just on the rise without explanation, and no one could really figure out why people were turning up with heart attacks and problems and such, and no one really paid attention or decided to look further into it until September 24th of 55, when President Eisenhower felt pain in his chest and realized that he was experiencing a heart attack at that time. And an acclaimed nutritionist, Ansel Keys, Harvard-educated, well-respected in the community, concluded that after analyzing all of the different food habits and civilizations around different parts of the world, he concluded that it was definitely the American high-fat diet which was causing this problem. So with that, media highly distributed this idea of Americans staying off fatty foods, switch to the low-fat diet. Everybody was still with the scare in the air of President Eisenhower, and they did switch to low-fat foods. Now, the problem with this, from those who were now no longer making so much money, the food manufacturers were not too pleased to see their high-fat foods continuing to sit on the shelf and not being sold, so they had to come up with low-fat alternatives, and this is what the media was telling everybody they needed to do. So top chefs and food chemists came up with a replacement which ended up being even more advantageous for the food manufacturers in the long run, because it was a product which the American public was already familiar with, but just not in this context, and it was refined sugar. The other reason it was a good substitute for the fat was that sugar, through many studies, was proven to create the same type of stimulation in the parts of the brain as addictive substances like cocaine and heroin. So food manufacturers were quick to do what was necessary to reset the equipment up and change their product formulations to have this refined sugar instead of fat, and it would create withdrawal symptoms when people would not have it, irritability and such. And even though at this time when they realized that they could put sugar instead of fat, even though there were already studies from many, many years ago dating back to the 1800s that showed that refined sugar was just as what was extremely detrimental on the animal test that had been done at that time, it was rolled out anyway. And it took off like wildfire, of course. People felt like, okay, I'm not doing the high-fat diet anymore. And even though it's got sugar, it's okay, because they say it's okay, it must be okay. And in 1939, a study was done on sugar in humans that was showing extremely detrimental effects, but that was kind of squashed and put to rest. And the sugar, the rage that had gone on, you know, since this the switch over from the fat to the sugars was more in the forefront, and people were definitely buying it, literally becoming addicted to it, and food manufacturers were taking the money to the bank and extremely happy with all this. Well, in 1957, to refute this study which had surfaced coming out from 1939, the History of Nutrition was published and widely distributed. This was something that authored by renowned biochemist E.V. McCollum, a professor at the University of Wisconsin. He said that all of those studies from 1939 and before were nothing to be concerned about, and that we should just ignore that and move forward. And so these copies were widely distributed, printed, given to educational institutions. And they did an excellent job of marketing this idea that the sugar, any prior studies about sugar being detrimental for human health were just complete bunk, and that they should disregard that and move forward with their high sugar consumption. But if you look just a little bit further, you'll see that on the underwriting page, that publication, The History of Nutrition, was underwritten by the Nutrition Foundation, which at first, you know, listened, sounds like it would be an organization that would have your best interest in mind. But, you know, looking beneath the surface again, you see that it was actually underwritten by the top sugar companies of the time. And they were very successful in their campaign to convince the public that sugar was just as healthy as water. And it went on for years and years and years, and the effects became evident pretty quickly. You know, within 10 to 20 years, a couple of decades, diabetes, heart attack, heart disease, obesity, just going through the roof, all of these unfortunate situations. And the only thing that eventually did come out of all of this kind of conflicting information, finally, in 1967, was the Fair Packaging and Labeling Act, which required the FTC and FDA, so Federal Trade Commission and the Food and Drug Administration, finally forced companies to indicate sugar on its labels. All that did at that time was really create a situation where they decided, well, how can we go along with this just a little bit more? Well, what we're going to do is just rename the product. And now we'll start calling it different things. I'm sure many of you are familiar with high fructose corn syrup, agave nectar, dextrose, sucrose, and a number of other maltodextrin type of terms used for sugar. And that worked for a while, where people were so programmed to look for that one word in the list of ingredients, and then they would just buy the product anyway. But eventually, and it didn't take too long, a couple of years, people started realizing, and the education piece was more widespread, and they realized that this is not a good thing. So then the food manufacturers had actually already something in the works. A couple of years before the Fair Packaging and Labeling Act came out, a company, G.D. Searle, an individual at that company, had discovered in 1965 aspartame. And even though it was directly linked to neurological problems, cancerous tumors, all kinds of devastating side effects, it was somehow pushed through to have approval from the FDA in dry food applications in 1981, and in 1985, they even approved it for beverages. I mean, this is a product that still to this day, so it was approved the FDA for beverages in 1985. We're talking 30 years later today, the year 2015. I was just at a meeting this afternoon, and the gentleman sitting across from me had a Diet Dr. Pepper, which I think still has aspartame in it. It may have another brand of artificial sweetener, but really they all fall in this category of extremely detrimental to the human body. And it produces numbness, rashes, heart palpitations, irritability and such, Alzheimer's, diabetes, chronic fatigue, brain tumors, birth defects. I mean, it's categorized as an excitotoxin. And the operative word there is toxin. It's not good for the human body. There's 90 symptoms in total, including seizures and death, which are documented as being associated with aspartame on a regular basis. And it continues to this day to account for 70% of the adverse reactions from food that are reported to the FDA, but it's still out there in circulation. So why am I telling you this? My point is, here's just a little snippet of history in the food industry that tells us that perhaps the government and the people that are in place are slow to react, and so it's better for you to do the research yourself and take care of yourself and your family and make sure that you stay healthy and reduce the toxic load on your body by both in the environment and through foods. When this all came to a head, the FDA finally opened up an investigation on G.D. Searle, and they, of course, were not going to just sit by G.D. Searle while this investigation was going on, so they went ahead and went to the attorney at the FDA and offered him a high-paying job at their company if he would step down from his position. And, of course, he did. Samuel Skinner went ahead and took that position at G.D. Searle, and then the investigation of their company and all aspartame-related investigations were, quote-unquote, put on hold. And then they appointed Donald Rumsfeld as CEO of Searle. He then appointed Arthur Hayes as the new FDA commissioner. Hayes created a commission to approve aspartame, and the commission included five people. Three of the five voted against aspartame. He couldn't allow, you know, he needed to have six people on the team in order to make votes on aspartame, and he put one more person on the group, of course. They ended up with 3-4 and three against aspartame. And then Hayes, of course, had to say that as FDA commissioner, he would need to break the tie. So, of course, aspartame got approved again, and it just followed on through like that, even though, as I said, there's all of these documented problems, and if you know anybody who's still consuming products with aspartame or you yourself, it is an excitotoxin. I would encourage you to look it up online and see what exactly it does inside the body and how many documented problems there can be. This is one of the easiest things that you can do to reduce the toxic load on your body. So one of the things that I always love to tell people when I speak about health and wellness is this fact. You have one vehicle in this lifetime, just one body. No matter how much money you have, no matter how little money you have, you get only one body. And I don't think anyone goes into this whole thing with the expectation of having to get on the waiting list for a replacement liver or replacement heart. And that's certainly not something, even if you have a lot of money, a situation that you would want to be in. So your filtration systems, your kidneys, your lungs, your liver, you want to reduce the toxic load as much as you can. And it is like becoming aware of what those toxic sources are that you can make those choices about where to reduce the toxic load and how to further fortify your body, that one and only vehicle that you have in this lifetime, to detoxify. So we'll talk a little bit about environmental toxins. I'm sure a lot of you have heard of something called sodium lauryl sulfate, It's a very popular product used in toothpaste, shampoo, mouthwash, body wash, detergents, all this type of thing. And it's basically a surfactant, what they call it. It essentially means it breaks the surface tension, separates the molecules, and to allow better interaction between the product and whatever you're doing, washing your hair, washing your hands, and such. So it creates that lather that so many people look for, and it's very inexpensive. So it's widely used in cleaning agents and also industrial applications, engine degreaser, industrial strength detergents. You know, but it really is also very well documented as being a highly, highly irritating product on the skin. So it's not a very good thing. Now, the story I just told you about the FDA and the evolution of aspartame and such, I tell you that so that you see kind of how the evolution has gone. Even though the documented problems are there, it's still an approved product on our market. And I say that and mention that in light of the fact that sodium lauryl sulfate, sometimes referred to as SLS, right now still officially is not a documented cause of cancer. That said, when you see how much skin irritation it has caused, and how many people have chosen to take it out of their interactions, you know, with shampoos and soaps and such, it has produced less irritation, and they are just able to live a higher quality of life. We have a certain amount of energy in our bodies which are going to be used to counteract all of the stressors which we come in contact with, whether that be from an emotional stress, physical stress, the natural reaction of the lactic acid which builds up in your body as you exercise, the environmental toxins that you come in contact with. But what you don't want to do is tax your body needlessly with all these extra little additives. So if sodium lauryl sulfate is something that might be beneficial to reduce or remove from your life, you know, it's something you might want to look at. And it is definitely something that even at a 1% of saturation has shown to be very highly irritating to the skin in humans. And yet the cleaning products have between 10 and 20% and sometimes even more than 50% of this concentration in the product. You know, so aside from just being a skin irritant, I'm sure you can imagine that breathing this product is not going to be good either. So it is definitely something to consider and be aware of. I would encourage you to read up on it more. Again, SLS, and there are some sister products similar to it, sodium laureth sulfate, SLES, and some other products in that genre. And all of them, it just taxes your immune and filtration systems in a way that's not necessary. And that's one of the most common. That's why I bring it up. There are a lot of course preservatives and chemicals and such that you don't want to come in contact with. Obviously, bleach and many of the commercial cleaning products that we've all just come to accept as normal in our lives are really something that we should not be breathing in. Now, in addition to the chemicals like such as sodium lauryl sulfate and others in the environment, I would encourage you to consider the formaldehydes, which are often used in processing of many of the fabrics that you come in contact with, either your bedding and linens, your clothing that you wear, the curtains that you're surrounded by and such. A lot of them have inherent formaldehydes, and especially if it's a permanent press or a wrinkle-resistant type of fabric, it's going to have formaldehyde in it that actually can't even be washed out. Sometimes when you purchase a new product that has formaldehyde in it, you can wash it alternating between vinegar and then baking soda to release the formaldehyde that might have been used in the processing of it. But in something that's permanent press or wrinkle resistant, you're pretty much never going to be able to get rid of it. And again, this is not something that's going to kill you, obviously. You know, we've had acceptable levels of toxins. We're surrounded by them in our food and in our environment. But you want to reduce them because as you understand how they affect you, you tend to think, okay, well, what can I do? Where can I cut this stuff out? Where can I reduce my exposure? And that's what we're looking to do here, is to reduce the exposure to these toxins. Now, we get onto the food arena. There are, again, so many toxic sources that most people are not aware of, and the food industry has kept us very much in the dark about, with perhaps our meat supply. You want to go with a grass-fed meat, grass-fed beef, because it traces back to the GMOs, genetically modified organisms. And genetically modified organism is something that is basically, it's a process of forcing genes from one species into another entirely unrelated species. So it's not just like crossbreeding or making a hybrid type of thing, which would be two related species, but GMO is forcibly breaching the naturally occurring barriers between two species. So here's an example. Corn plus the DNA from soil bacteria, which is naturally immune to Roundup herbicide, plus the addition of E. coli bacteria, plus soil bacteria that causes tumors in plants, which would enable the plant's cell wall to be breached, will then equal quote-unquote Roundup-ready corn. So it's so unnerving. And when you boil it down to an acronym like GMO, you think, well, how bad can GMO be? Because really when you understand that some GMO, in the beginning at least, was produced under the guise of being able to feed the hungry of the world. And so, yes, I guess you would think on the surface that if it takes all of that genetic modification to come up with a strain of plant which can look beautiful and take a lot of spraying of herbicides and insecticides in order to produce a high volume of product that is going to be able to feed people that would otherwise not be able to eat, that'd be better. But that's not our situation in the U.S., and it's really unfortunate because we don't need to have this kind of modification. We can have smaller yields, and the profits can be cut down from companies like Monsanto so that we're getting safe food. You know, on that same line of thought, or a similar line of thought, as far as GMO goes, I mentioned the hybridization. Wheat, American wheat, and unfortunately it seems like much of the wheat supply in the world now is what has been hybridized, what is understood to be hybridized. So they'll say, okay, wheat is not GMO. And so you immediately think, okay, so it's safe. But it's been hybridized, which means that it's been crossbred with grasses, which are originally designed for cows to be eating, and they've got multiple stomachs to digest grasses. Humans don't have that, but the hybridization of wheat has produced a very short stalk of wheat. You no longer see the amber waves of grain with the tall wheat in the field, but the short stalk of wheat, which is highly Roundup resistant. Actually, it's not genetically modified, but it has got so many different proteins of wheat that our bodies, humans, cannot digest it. So if a cow can digest a grass and other grains that have multiple different proteins of wheat in it, we can't digest it anymore. So a lot of the problems that we're seeing with wheat today and the suspected gluten sensitivities and such are not so much that, in that the wheat that we're having, at least largely in America, has been changed to a point that it's hybridized and no longer digestible under normal circumstances. So that just, it creates a big mess, and you want to be able to take in the things that are going to be most beneficial for you, not that are going to further tax your filtration systems. So I'll talk a little bit about a couple of foods that you can implement that will definitely help in cleaning out your kidneys and your livers and such. Number one is turmeric. It has curcumin in it, chemical found that can help reduce joint pain, lower your blood sugar so you'll be able to control your food consumption. It's being touted in the medical community as fountain of youth super spice. It really is good at helping your liver to flush out carcinogens, and it helps your bodies to burn fat and filter everything. So it's very prevalent in Indian food. I'm sure for those of you who like Indian food, you're well aware of that. Another food category is the cruciferous vegetables. And you'll want to pay close attention to this because they have what is called DIM. It's a short term for a scientific term that basically says we are anti-estrogenic. So DIM is strongly anti-estrogenic, and it helps to block xenoestrogens. This is important because xenoestrogens are what comes out of the environmental toxins I mentioned earlier. You know, come in contact with sodium lauryl sulfate. I didn't get to touch on a lot of these, but these are things from chemical fumes and synthetic fibers, perfumes, and pesticides and such. These things come into your body, xenoestrogens. They're bad estrogens. They accumulate inside the body. They may not exhibit any symptoms for years and years, but eventually they store in your body to a point where, for women, it often shows up as more belly fat and difficulty in letting go of weight. And for men, they have really chronically low testosterone levels. So this is, and also the man boobs, you know, issue they've got with that. So the DIM and the cruciferous vegetable will act as an immunostimulant, have potent anti-cancer properties, boost the immune system, and it'll help to get these xenoestrogens out of your body. So this is how you can help to get rid of stuff if you know you've come in contact with them. And obviously some of the most popular ones be broccoli, cauliflower, cabbage, spinach. And for those of you in the more foodie and new and innovative types of greens and vegetables, and if you haven't tried them yet, I would strongly suggest the Swiss chard, arugula, kale, bok choy, collard greens, watercress. These things are great. And another wonderful thing is that they are oil-soluble. The DIM, which is strongly anti-estrogenic and cruciferous vegetables mentioned, is oil soluble, which means that it'll be most readily absorbed if you eat it with healthy oils and fats, such as grass-fed butter. So quickly onto the dairy products. You'll want to avoid dairy products that have recombinant bovine growth hormone in it. You'll look for a small little disclaimer that'll say no RBST added, or no RBGH, that lets you know that those cows have not been treated with that growth hormone. And
perfect. I have to stop real quick, and so we can switch over to the next presenter.
Okay.
So thank you, Patricia, for being on. And make sure, how can they get a hold of you? Obviously, they're going to have lots of questions for you.
I do have a quick synopsis of this, a bullet point explanation that I'll be happy to email to them if they want to. Email me directly at patriciaeobrien@yahoo.com. That's patriciaeobrien@yahoo.com. And I'll email you the notes on this, which will have the rest of the discussion I didn't get to.
Perfect.